a lot of you know that Nevada has completely changed their dynamic in terms of how the state party operates. It is now a non-corporate progressive state party.
Yeah.
And the Lone Star State is attempting to go in that direction as well. And who better to try to make that happen than two of the more progressive candidates who just ran for Congress in the Lone Star State, Julie Oliver and Mike Siegel, two of the slate mates of Brand New Congress with Jen. Welcome to Generational Change.
Hey, y'all.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us.
Absolutely. You know, I never got to meet you guys. I think you guys both joined the BNC slate after the summit. And so I never got to meet you. So I'm glad I get to meet you. And I'm really excited that there are people working like you guys and what you're working for in Texas, because I actually really do like Texas. And I think people have this vision of what people are like in Texas. And I think that they're very mistaken. I think that what most people envision is what we know of is maybe like East Texas or maybe up somewhere like where the tumbleweeds are. But there's a lot of left leaning people in Texas. So why don't I don't know which one of you, whoever wants to sort of say how this came about, like how you guys decided to do this. And we could just go from there.
I would say that Mike and I both probably have differing genesis stories of how we got here, but we maintained contact over these last 4 years and even after the election, and decided that, you know, we really do need to do year-round organizing. That is one of the things that Democrats are guilty of not doing, is year-round organizing. And I shared a Civis post-mortem report. Civis is a national data analytics firm. I shared that with Mike. It had some really startling information on issues that outperform Democrats everywhere: Medicaid expansion, minimum wage increase, and marijuana decrim. And Mike had this brilliant idea. It's like, what if we do this on a ballot initiative level, city by city in Texas, because we are prohibited from doing so on a statewide level. Mike, how would you change the genesis story?
Yeah, I mean, we both ran for Congress twice, ran these kind of, strong progressive campaigns. We built a lot of support, kind of gave people hope, and ultimately hit a little bit of a wall at the end because of COVID taking our field programs offline and the Trump wave being a very impressive force here in Texas. But yeah, we want to do year-round work. We have criticisms of the party, and especially the DCCC and the DNC and how they intervene in politics. And I mean, we just want to add to the constellation of universes of organizations that are already working in Texas. I mean, one question Julie and I get sometimes is, well, are y'all going to be the next Stacey Abrams of Texas? And we hate that question. No. We have no such pretensions. I mean, first of all, there's a lot of amazing folks doing great work here. Organizations like Texas Organizing Project, you know, Move Texas, Workers Defense Project, that are doing amazing work, especially in the big cities. And also, Texas is so big. I mean, it kind of goes to your question about people's perceptions of Texas. This is a country in and of itself, right?
Yeah.
And Beto O'Rourke, when he ran for Senate, kept saying, I've been to all 254 counties. And I mean, we have 254 counties. It takes, you know, 10 hours to drive from Austin to El Paso. And, you know, there's another rest of the state to the east. And so it's a huge state. And what Julie and I feel like where we can fit into the folks who are already doing good work is basically like a progressive messaging strategy, city by city. And it's like these issues that Julie mentioned that outperformed Joe Biden in 2020. I mean, these are all Republican states: Florida expanding the minimum wage, Nebraska cracking down on payday lending, Missouri expanding Medicaid, you know, South Dakota legalizing weed. These are all Trump states, and yet they're passing statewide progressive issues. And what we want people to do is start to associate Democrats with the issues they like. And unfortunately, in Texas, the Democratic brand is weak. And so what we think we can do is build these city-based campaigns to decriminalize marijuana, to raise the minimum wage, at least for city and contractor jobs, to a living wage. You know, bit by bit, if we can build a coalition here and get 10,000 extra votes out, a coalition there, build 15,000 new voters, like that adds up. And that could be the long-term strategy for changing Texas.
I think that it's amazing. Oh, I'm sorry, Peter. I was just going to say, we very much have been employing this same concept of you don't end when the campaign season is over. And that's the biggest problem. You end up losing your momentum. And so the biggest thing we can do, and this is why I always talk about like a campaign in and of itself, win or lose, it can be part of the progression of the narrative. And if you use that to steamroll into the next campaign and the next campaign, it's chipping away at it. And it's so important to be doing it. And we definitely agree that doing it at local level will yield the best results. And it makes it harder for the establishment to blacklist you when you're working at the local level.
Agreed.
We're speaking with Julie Oliver and Mike Siegel of the new organization, Ground Game Texas. You know, in Florida, we have, I think we have five states. I would call it five. I would say we have the Panhandle, we have the Jacksonville area, we have Central Florida, and then we have Southwest and Southeast. How would you describe Texas in terms of its
region? It's kind of similar. It's kind of similar.
How you would break it up. I mean, obviously, you have your own Panhandle. I know South Texas is one. Central Texas is definitely its own region. But how would you guys describe it?
Yeah, you got the Gulf Coast, which is its own region. You got East Texas. You got West Texas. Is El Paso a part of West Texas, or is El Paso its own little thing? I mean, some people say South Texas and the Rio Grande Valley are actually two different things.
Yeah.
North Texas.
Yeah. And we have a Panhandle as well.
Yeah. I've actually been to Lubbock. I have to say that there's really nothing there. There's not a whole lot of there. No offense to people from Lubbock. Shout out to my law classmate, Doug Nagley. Great guy. Nice wedding, the whole thing. But God, there's really nothing in Lubbock. And where I lived was San Antonio, which is a completely different vibe than a lot of other places. Certainly different than Austin or Houston or the Metroplex. And I think that there is a lot of progressive stuff there, more than we have in Florida. Which is interesting. So where are you guys starting your camp? Like, where have you already sort of rooted or planted roots? Like, where are you starting and spreading?
So we actually are starting in Austin, of all places. And we didn't expect to have to do this on our own home turf. Austin is a fairly, you know, they call Austin the blueberry and the tomato soup, right? But we're starting in Austin for a couple of reasons. One, you know, in off-year elections, again, Democrats tend to go to sleep. Yeah. And we want to wake them up. We need to give them something to work for this year, because guess what? Republicans don't give up. They are working year round. Yeah. And we need to turn people out in off-year elections. And we think that we can do that through this ballot initiative. We think we can keep people engaged and volunteering, doing this work. And we need to do that so we don't lose that momentum. And the other reason, quite honestly, is we think that, you know, Travis County GOP has something up their sleeve. They did an anti-homelessness proposition in May. No candidates were elected. It was just an anti-homelessness proposition. They got a very right-wing city council member elected last December in a runoff election. And you don't pour millions of dollars into ballot initiatives if you don't have something coming up the next year. And so we think that this is something that is incredibly popular. 87% of Texans believe that marijuana should be decriminalized in some form or fashion. And this is absolutely a way to get young people to turn out. Study after study and election after election where marijuana has been on the ballot shows it positive increase in youth turnout. And ultimately, we do want young people turning out to vote. We want them to feel engaged, and we want them to take power of their local elections.
So is this initiative something that, where has Texas been with the marijuana process? I mean, like right now we have medicinal in Florida. We're still trying to get recreational. Even our medicinal is so like hamstrung by regulations that it's made it almost like a little corporate oligarchy at the top, which it has its whole own set of problems. So where is Texas now in terms of the legislation for marijuana?
I mean, very limited progress. I mean, there's a tiny CBD program and there's an even tinier medicinal marijuana program. And it's like each of those things is only available to people with like one symptom of one syndrome. You know, it's like, right. You know, like severe seizures, I think you can get CBD. I forgot what marijuana was. The marijuana program is so tiny as to be non-existent. And it's really, you know, what we think it is, it's a wedge issue that works in our favor.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you know, some people have asked us, like, why do you want to focus on marijuana? You know, there's voting rights, there's housing, there's so many more important issues.
Not to motivate the kids.
Well, I mean, yeah. So first, yes, you're right. These issues are more important. Tax reform is frankly more important, you know, but the Republicans don't talk about their most important issue. I mean, their most important issue is protecting their wealth and privilege and power. Right. But yet they're talking about AR-15s and forcing women to maintain a pregnancy. You know, Karl Rove is considered to be a genius because in 2004, he put gay marriage bans on many state ballots and helped elect GW, right? They weaponize these wedge issues. Why can't we?
Oh, I think it's great. But so who are you working with your initiative and like in terms of the language of it? Because we last year had two different marijuana ballot initiatives that were being passed around. One was good and one was bad, but most people don't know the difference. So they just hear legalized marijuana. Sure, I'll sign it. Well, one of ours didn't allow for home grow. And if you don't allow for home grow, then that opens up this whole problem that we're going to have here. So that's how it's important to get the legislation right on that. And most people don't know the difference.
Yeah, so we are even baby steps from there. We're basically telling the City of Austin Police Department that they should not arrest or give tickets for low-level marijuana offenses, Class A and Class B misdemeanors. And then there's this wrinkle that the Republicans actually created an opportunity for us in 2019. The Texas legislature legalized industrial-scale hemp production. And that, you know, these Republicans, they were taking money from the hemp lobby, and they thought they were so smart. And after that bill passed, district attorneys and police forces realized, oh, no. I don't know if I'm allowed to swear on this show, but like, you know, oh, shit. How do we now prove up a marijuana case? Because the smell of the substance, well, who's to say low THC hemp smells different than high THC marijuana? Or the burning substance, like, does it smell different? Does it look different? And what the DA's
funny found, you ask those questions. I could actually open up my door and get a lot of those answers. I'm currently in a camper on a cannabis farm. So,
long story short, they realized that to prove up a case, they had to pay for chemical testing, basically THC testing, and it cost money. And so what some DA started doing was saying, we're not going to prosecute these cases. It's not worth it. We have bigger priorities. And so what this ordinance would do is, in addition to telling the police don't go after low-level marijuana possession, is we're not going to pay for testing.
Right.
And basically, there's been a test program in Austin where they basically went from thousands of tickets a year to zero, hundreds of arrests a year to zero. And this measure would formalize that and make it permanent in Austin. And what we're hoping to do is to have other cities take notice, because we're doing this in an off year. But what if we could have this in multiple cities next year, especially in the general election ballot? What if, like, you know, let's just say that guy Beto runs for governor, but then you've got weed on all these city ballots, and that helps create more excitement for the.
Oh, it'll get out the vote. It absolutely gets out the vote. And I think that that's a great idea. It's actually strange to me that I would have thought that Austin would have been a city that would have decriminalized by now, because like we even Fort Lauderdale has. And the best way to do it, if you get to a state attorney that is not going to prosecute them, then the police will stop arresting them because it won't go anywhere. So it's really not something that the police will, it's not going to be, it's not their discretion that's the issue. If they know that that's not going to be prosecuted by the state attorney, they're going to stop arresting the people.
In Austin, they actually, by resolution, effectively ended enforcement of low-level marijuana possession cases. However, it took APD almost a year to implement it, and I think it was electing a very progressive DA who wasn't going to prosecute those cases. That's probably what turned the tide. So what we want to do is codify this. It's never been codified in Austin. In the off chance that we get a new police chief or a DA down the road that may want to, you know, go back to the old days of enforcing this. And so they're baby steps. But I do think that if we can kind of knit together a city by city framework of decriminalizing or ending enforcement, because that's what we have to do in Texas to kind of push us there, then I think that realistically we can perhaps have a state legislative session where they very seriously consider lifting the ban on cannabis. So that's our
hope. That is how it happened in other places. I mean, that is ultimately how it happened in Colorado, because I remember there was a period of time before they legalized recreational. And I was there and I was in Breckenridge. And in Breckenridge, they had decided that they are just not prosecuting the cases anymore. They're just not doing it. They don't care. They're not prosecuting it. And so, yeah, it was like sort of like a nice refuge for potheads to hang out in Breckenridge. And that was cool. But eventually it did start to grow. Like eventually that did start to take hold. And for the most part, state attorneys, they don't want to be bothered with this. It is so like, other than its revenue, Because that's the thing about it is it's revenue. Like somebody just said where they, I don't know if it's, oh, El Paso here, this one. And so it's basically like traffic tickets. It's just another source of revenue stream, which, you know, I guess that's, it's better than criminalization, but it's still kind of annoying.
Oh, you know, it'd be a better revenue stream. Yeah. Sorry, Mike, a better revenue stream would be to decriminalize it and tax it.
Yes, absolutely.
Legalize it. Yeah.
We're speaking with Julie Oliver and Mike Siegel of Ground Game Texas. You know, one of the major problems we have in Florida, we got plenty. Gerrymandering is a very serious issue. I have seen Dan Crenshaw's district. His is probably the best example of what gerrymandering.
Somebody was just talking about it in the chat.
Yeah, gerrymandering at its very worst actually looks like. I'm curious as to what type of a movement as far as trying to unwind some of the gerrymandering issues that exist in the state. You guys, obviously, for anybody who is not aware, I will say that the Texas Democratic Party actually has cojones. Not many states actually do. And what they did very recently to prevent, was it like a voter restriction law that they were basically trying to push through? And the Texas Democrats were just like, yeah, we're not having this shit. You know, we're definitely going to, you know, stand on principle, if nothing else. You never see like something like that in Florida. So I'm curious as to, as part of your organization, if, you know, gerrymandering is an issue that you guys are focusing on as an overall party in terms of how you properly deal with something like that.
Yeah, I'll say a little about it. I mean, yeah, we give our state house reps a lot of credit. You know, it hasn't been very frequent that like you're really proud of a state house delegation. I mean, I love these people, but they've been in the minorities for so long that it's a very disempowering experience. But they basically went on strike. You know, they took the action that they could take. And they stopped this like 12 or 20 part horrible vote suppression bill that was going to do everything from make it harder for disabled people to vote to, you know, shortening voting hours. I mean, just all these tremendous, terrible measures. And so big picture, yeah, we need a movement to fight voter suppression and gerrymandering. The problem is that right now the Republicans control all the levers. I mean, other than the courts. And so if they overstep a little bit, you can sue them. But really what Julie and I are trying to embrace is a long-term strategy for political change, because it's not looking real good right now. But one of the things we can do is as soon as they issue the maps, we can create a strategy to find which Republicans were left vulnerable, you know, and what cities do those folks represent, and what city campaigns can we develop that will motivate turnout to get rid of those folks. Because part of the conversation, and I'll pass it to you, Julie, is like what happened in Georgia, for example, or in Arizona, where they flipped the state, right? Those were 10, 15 year processes. I mean, in Texas, I'm not sure people have been really investing here, except like maybe right after Trump got elected, like since 16, 17. But we're definitely not at year 10 of like the deep investment in infrastructure. And so we're trying to have like a little bit of a longer horizon, not chase the sugar high of winning the next election, but like doing the right things that if we keep doing them over time, that will really set in motion kind of generational change.
Well, perfect segue into generational change. Sorry.
I was going to add one little thing to Mike, and Mike knows this really well. One of the things that we've also analyzed is that gerrymandered Democratic congressional districts did not do their jobs of turning out voters in the November 2020 election. And so we analyzed all 36 congressional races in Texas, and it was a very disappointing realization that the 11 safe Democratic congressional districts were the worst in turnout in Texas. So they were the bottom third. And so, you know, it hurts us both ways, having, you know, gerrymandered Republican districts in which Mike and I both ran and put thousands of miles on our respective family cars, tens of thousands of miles on our respective family cars. But it also cuts the other way, that once a Democrat makes it through the primary, they don't do the work for November. And so we really do need to figure out ways that we can leverage this tool to inspire people to vote for good candidates, regardless of whether they're challenging a Republican or challenging an incumbent Democrat.
Speaking with Julie Oliver and Mike Siegel of Ground Game Texas, former slate mates with Jen Perlman on Brand New Congress. I'm curious, you know, a lot of times we debate constantly about what is ultimately going to pique the interest of the voter. I don't particularly find that especially the independent voter, I would say specifically, really cares very much about the party politics stuff. They really care about issues. And I'm curious if there are specific issues that you find that voters really do respond well to. Could be, as you were talking about, cannabis decriminalization at a minimum, but things like Medicare for all, things like ending the drug war altogether,
living wage.
What are the types of issues that Texans are responding to, regardless of party affiliation?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. And again, if you look at the data shows that people do care about these issues deeply. They do care about, and I ran primarily on Medicare for All because my background is in healthcare finance, and it was something that I could easily kind of explain from my vantage point. And I could get Republicans to say, wow, that's a really good idea. Why don't we have this? Like, yeah. Why don't we? But I think, you know, going back to just even what the 2020 elections look like, you know, healthcare was obviously an important issue. But Mike and I, as DCCC approved candidates, were told to you know, campaign on affordable healthcare. Well, that doesn't mean anything. That's a nothing. That's a nothingism. That's a nothing burger. I'm sorry. That's a giant nothing burger. Talk about protections for pre-existing conditions. Well, if you're 65 and older and on Medicare, that's non-existent. Medicare covers it. And if you're one of the 31 million people who are uninsured and an additional, you know, 10, 20 million who are underinsured, you know, protecting pre-existing conditions doesn't mean anything. Let's be substantive. Mike and I stand for, and we think the Democratic Party should stand for, three things. It's easy: workers, wages, and weed. And another framing is, you know, climate, care, jobs, and justice. But it's very, very simple.
Yeah, I think another issue in Texas that is something that could be tricky is immigration. And it's one of those things. I actually clerked in the Western District of Texas, and the magistrate judge that I clerked for, mostly what we heard were cases from the border. That was like a huge thing, and what's going on at the border. And it is one of the things that the Republicans use to really instill fear, dredge that up, get everybody out and anti-immigrant. And I think Texas is someplace where that is definitely visible, especially given this whole that now Biden is continuing to build the wall. And it's like, I look at Texas and I think, okay, last time you guys had a power crisis and couldn't have power for however many days, but yet there's somehow we have the money to put up a giant wall between us and Mexico. So how do you find the immigration issue lands with people down there? And do you find that that's something that is, you know, it's kind of incendiary, and it's in San Antonio is also very different than a lot of the other places. So, yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's tough. I mean, a lot of Democrats in Texas are scared of the immigration issue, right? To say, like, you know, what Julian Castro, when he was running for president, talked about getting away with the law that basically criminalizes border crossings,
yeah,
and return it to be a civil issue. And I supported that as a candidate. Some people told me not to, you know, be more moderate. And there's this fear that, like, if we get associated with, you know, folks crossing the border, that it's going to weaken our brand. But what I think is that, and Julie shares this as well, we need to stand in solidarity on racial justice and immigrant justice issues. So we need to stand with the Black community and demand that Black Lives Matter, you know, march in the George Floyd protests on down the line, demand comprehensive, you know, criminal justice reform. And we need to stand with our immigrant community and cannot allow one inch of these folks to be demonized for seeking a better life here.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we also need to pivot to economic justice. And, you know, you might have heard of this idea of the race class narrative that some folks are pivoting, you know, framing. And I think Julie can describe it better than I can. But one way I think about it is it shouldn't be right versus left. It should be bottom versus top, right?
Yeah.
And this idea that in Texas, there is a strong history of populism. I mean, going back 100 years before, like if you read this is one of the famous books in Texas, the biography of LBJ, it's like four or five volumes. And you ask anyone if they've read it, they're like, I've read some of book one. But like LBJ's dad was a populist, you know, like from that old like agrarian populist movement. And that strand is still there. And I think you're talking about the power grid issue is so perfect, because to me, that should be the response to anything Greg Abbott wants to do. Like, you're taking emergency relief money for this border wall stunt and you can't fix the damn grid. I mean, that is an issue that unites people, that broadens the base, instead of like these very narrowly, carefully calibrated, poll tested issues. Let's talk about power. I mean, because that's the most basic function of the government, right? To make sure we're safe and healthy. So I think there's a lot of work to be done. And I don't know if you want to add to that, Julie.
Yeah, I would just say that, you know, no matter our backgrounds or the color of our skin, we all want to be able to turn on the lights and have heat in the winter.
Yeah. So I don't know if you guys can see this, but this might be a good idea for your organization to do stickers that say workers' wages and weed. We actually, on our campaign, had a support legalized marijuana from our campaign, and we gave it out to all the college kids, all the high school kids, and they had like support legalized marijuana. But I really think workers' wages and weed could be that's kind of a cool thing.
Coming soon. That's actually the design is coming next week. Actually,
there we'll you have go. A store. Yeah. That's a good one, and you'll be able to sell that merch too.
Yeah,
we're speaking with Billy Oliver and Mike Siegel of Ground Game Texas. You know, personalities unfortunately dominate where a lot of people end up going. Governor Abbott is kind of a very, he's a very bland politician. He doesn't, you know, obviously he's going to get the R voters. It's really a question of whether he gets enough independents versus a potential Democrat.
Sidebar, I didn't vote for him as attorney general either because I thought he was a piece of crap then. So onward, sorry.
But he is not a lightning rod the way that Ted Cruz is. And I am curious as to, you know, how you guys see that unfolding, because I think Abbott's handling of this energy crisis. And this isn't, you know, the reason why I do think Abbott could potentially be vulnerable is because this isn't a one-off, you know, incident. This is something that has been stemming for quite some time. He has handled this horrifically bad. And of course, the reason he's handling it horrifically bad is because he is deep in the back pocket of the fossil fuel industry. So with that said, how important is Ground Game Texas to being able to, whether it is Beto or somebody else, having a formidable shot at actually having a governor who, even if the, you know, even if Austin is not a blue state house, it's at least a state house that will have a governor that can block really horrific bills, much like we have to deal with here with the Florida GOP.
Yeah. And I want to remind people, in Texas, we have the line item veto. So the governor gets to go line by line and veto legislation he or she doesn't like. And in Texas, I do think that what we are doing with Ground Game Texas is incredibly pivotal, because if you think about increasing turnout, I'm going to give you an example, two examples, actually. One is Killeen, Texas, a very diverse community that sits right outside of Fort Hood. Fort Hood is the largest military installation in the United States. Very diverse community, full of veterans, but their turnout for the 2020 November election was 49%. 49%. We didn't even make it up to 50%. And that is a city that, if we actually increase turnout by 5%, we flip a state house substantially. It's not going to be a close race. It's going to be a landslide. If we increase turnout by 10%, you've flipped a congressional. If congressional district 31 looks similar to the way it looked this year, similar to how it looked in 2020. This is such a pivotal community, and all it takes is driving turnout and decriminalize marijuana and allowing veterans to have options when it comes to, you know, chronic pain management is incredibly important to them. They've been lobbying the state legislature for this for years, and the state legislature has ignored them. So I do think that this is something that we can bring to Killeen, increase turnout, and actually add 20,000 votes to a city, just one city. Now imagine doing that across a dozen cities. And you have the work, again, of other organizations doing really amazing work in big cities. Mike and I are focused on the mid-sized cities. This is how you start flipping seats. We still have a long-term view of things. I don't want to come in and say, we're going to flip everything in 2022. I think that's unrealistic to couch it in those terms. But I think it is very likely that we can make some very strong impacts in some local races, some congressional races, and perhaps the statewide race that matters the most. And I do think that's going to be the governor race.
Yeah, people forget, but you know, Texas was a state that had Ann Richards as a governor. And I met her, and she was badass and just really cool. But the point is that there are those niches of people there. It is not what people, and it's not that different from Florida, Peter. It really isn't. It's very similar. And it's also it's the kind of state that is really very county or like isolated. Like it's not as centralized. It's not like that. It's much more diverse.
Yeah, we have that, you know, one of the biggest environmental issues in Florida is obviously we're a peninsula, so we're very low. You know, I mean, you want to talk about we don't have to get too deep into the weeds with what happened in Surfside, but you know, that's just one of many circumstances because of sea level rise and the issue with climate change that is now starting to get to the surface, and the average dupe, if you will, is starting to see it, because most people don't care unless they can feel it, they can see it, and they can touch it. So now it's becoming a really, really serious problem. Now, Texas is a very interesting state because you're, I believe you're one of the leaders, if not the leader, in wind energy, which is amazing. But you're still, you know, way up there when it comes to obviously fossil fuels, specifically fracking. I'm curious as to what the environmental movement looks like in Texas, how serious that is, and if that's also something that's being incorporated into Ground Game Texas.
Right. Well, I'll jump in on this. I mean, Julie was running on Medicare for All, and I was running on the Green New Deal. I mean, we both supported both issues, but the district I ran in for Congress, it was like, there's a coal plant, this 40-year-old coal plant that's, you know, killing 12 surrounding counties. And the district I ran in touched Houston and obviously, you know, epicenter of the international petroleum industry. And there is a strong environmental movement in Texas. I mean, there's Sierra Club, there's 350. There's a lot of like Sunrise chapters that I've been really engaged with. There are these other organizations that have been active, but obviously they're not in power. And labor, I think, is the key to this. I mean, we don't have a very strong labor movement in Texas because of right to work.
Same.
But we do have a strong, I mean, it's not as strong as it could be, but we have a powerful set of labor organizations, the Texas AFL-CIO. Now, half of those labor organizations on average statewide are a fossil fuel, you know, building trades unions and fossil fuel related industries. And so that's the key. And that's one of the, like, my pet projects, or like my passion projects, I should say, is like, how can we get labor on board with the idea of a just transition? The idea that we're going to create the jobs, because we know folks are going to lose jobs if we close the coal plants, close the gas plants and so forth. But the federal government should be guaranteeing these folks, you know, their future employment, their future income, to make sure that workers are not suffering for these macroeconomic changes and energy changes that we need. And to me, I would love to do that. I think we do have opportunities. You know, right now, Julie and I are working in different cities that are exploring this ARPA money, the federal LEAF money that's come down. Could that be used to fund a just transition? Like, I'm talking to these, and I call them kids, the Sunrise activists. They're not all, you know, teenagers, but
I call them kids too.
That is the best national organization that I've seen in the country.
I love these folks so much. I mean, they are strategic. They're hardworking. Yep. They're smart. They're dedicated.
And they get their candidates across the finish line. I mean, they probably made the difference for Cori Bush at the 11 o'clock hour.
Oh, exactly.
There's no question that what they are doing is absolutely you know, incredible. And Mike, you really hit it on the head. I would definitely, we have universally agreed that probably the biggest roadblock that Jen had to face against Wasserman Schultz was the head of the Broward County AFL-CIO. His name is Dan Reynolds. He's been at it probably as long as she's been at it, which is 30 years, which is, again, a lifetime in many ways. I do think that a non-corporate, even to some degree, non-partisan labor movement is the future.
Yeah.
That is where you're going to get the most amount of people who are going to say, I do agree with the universal health care, because unions have to negotiate health care to begin with, and that would save them a lot of money, increase salary. And of course, people believe in a living wage. And then as it relates to the Green New Deal, it's a jobs program. It's a clean energy jobs program. And if there's a state that loves to brag about how they are the number one state for jobs in America, it is the Lone Star State. They absolutely want to be number one in that category by any means necessary, which is why I think a lot of the communities, like I've read some very conservative communities. I don't remember where, maybe you guys could remind me of the name, but there's a very conservative community in Central Texas that basically runs its entire community on renewable energy.
Georgetown.
Yeah. There you go. What a perfect name too, you know?
Well, okay, so I want to remind people too, and I have my I've put my little handy dandy like notepad that I take important notes on and I don't throw away. This really is a workers' justice issue. If you look at the CEO compensation of the oil and gas, just CEO, we're not talking CFO, we're not talking about vice presidents, just the CEO. A daily compensation for the CEO of ExxonMobil, who made the news recently, $64,000 every day. Just the CEO, $64,000 every day of the year, 365 days. That means he makes $64,000 on Monday, and he makes $64,000 on Tuesday, and he makes What, I mean, my God, if you talk about Kinder Morgan is really big in Texas because they're just plowing through, you know, people's ranch lands, through communities to, you know, because they, you know, straight line connects 2 points and they don't want to go around like, you know, rivers or anything, you know, historic landmarks, anything. They want to do a straight line. So they're just plowing through tons of property in Texas. Mr. Kinder made over $1 billion in stock gains. And he was a former Enron employee. You know, ConocoPhillips, $82,000 a day, CEO. There's not, you know, any worker that makes even a fraction of that salary or compensation. It's ridiculous.
And so how do these people not have guillotines being built in front of their houses on a regular basis? I really don't understand it. I think it's like it's not even a secret where people live. I don't understand how people come and go in peace on a regular basis because they're not going to be able to build moats wide enough. I'm sorry, but this is just out of control.
Well, my understanding is that the neighborhood that the richest of the rich in Texas live in, which is in North Dallas, where Kelsey Warren lives, where Mark Cuban lives, you know, I forgot the name of the town, but you have to see how high these homes go on the hill, where basically it's like a fortress. Like you said, you know, are they going to build the moats wide enough to protect their property?
No. Because
that's kind of what they're doing.
Well,
they're,
ultimately, you know, the real thing, and I've always thought this, we are one smart hacker away from somebody taking the money from the rich and giving it to the poor. And that's how it's going to be. I think it'll be cyber. I don't think it'll actually be like a physical. I mean, although that too, because people are getting desperate and angry. But I think it's going to be a financial thing more so, and a digital thing more than a physical thing.
We're speaking with Julie Oliver and Mike Siegel of Ground Game Texas. One of the last things we want to talk about is income inequality. Now in Florida, we're the number one state in the country for that. It's not a surprise. But I do think that much like Florida, Texas is, as you were saying, Mike, it's kind of ground zero for a populist uprising because there are, you know, Texas in a lot of places is a rich tourist industry. A lot of people work in, you know, they work for the service industry. So that, you know, whether they're bartenders, servers, all different types of service jobs. And I can't help but think that the right person or the right people speaking that language to them is really going to build a massive, no pun intended, ground game that's going to allow for this change to happen. Because I think a lot of people are just fed up. They just don't really know where to direct their anger. But in the state of Florida, income inequality is one of, without question, the top issues we have over development, you know, and they grease the wheels of both sides of the aisle. So I'm curious as to what that looks like in Texas and if that is one of the more major issues that not only you're dealing with, but you guys are looking to fight for.
You know, I don't think it's been done yet to really mobilize poor people in Texas. I don't think it's been done yet. You know, if you think about Beto's campaign, it really mobilized a lot of people. But if you looked at his most frequent volunteers and rally attendees, it was like middle-aged white women.
Yeah.
I love them. They were very helpful in my campaign as well. But, you know, in terms of speaking to poor people, we need to analyze that more as a left, because like if you go to a Walmart, if you're in these working class communities, people are so disconnected from this political conversation we're having right now. And to me, the closest that came to it was Bernie Sanders. And we never really got to see Bernie campaign in Texas, just for different factors. But to me, that kind of like real populist rhetoric, you know, let's go after the billionaires kind of mentality, that hasn't really happened yet in Texas. And frankly, even though Julie and I, for example, ran very progressive campaigns, we were constrained by the ticket we were on. And, you know, think about how much bandwidth the average person has to spend on politics. And then you're on a ticket with Joe Biden. You're on a ticket with MJ Hager, who is a very moderate Democratic nominee for Senate. Like, who has the bandwidth to listen to the congressional candidate? And so I'm still waiting for that kind of person or figure to emerge, like that kind of populist campaign to emerge. I mean, to me, we would like to do that at the city level. I mean, we would love for there to be a measure on the ballot that's like, do you want 1,000 jobs, yes or no? It could be that what we're doing is taking money from other sources that are pet projects of the powers that be to pay for those 1,000 jobs. But to me, that's one tactic we have. I don't know if you have more to add on that, Julie.
Yeah, I mean, oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you know, we're living in a city that it kind of is the exacerbation of exactly what you're talking about. It's an incredibly unequal an inequitable city. Housing is incredibly unaffordable. And we do, unfortunately, have a deep, deep homelessness issue in population that most people here want to sweep under the rug, as evidenced by the election that happened this past May. And I do think that perhaps coming out of this particular year and seeing, with Proposition B in Austin, you know, recriminalizing homelessness, again, trying to sweep it under the rug, I am hoping that we can get some folks, and the service industry just being hammered by coronavirus and the shutdowns. That was a tragedy for you know, people who are not making a living wage. And I'm with Mike. I'm hoping that we get that candidate that will make that a big issue and that people can rally around that, because there are a lot of people hurting. I mean, millions of people in Texas that are hurting. I think I read that there are like 1 in 4 people are housing insecure in Texas, meaning they are on the brink of losing what little housing they have. That 1 in 4. I mean, that's astonishing. And it's all part of income inequality, because we aren't paying people living wages. When I was campaigning, I met a woman in Killeen who was living out of her car with her 2 children. One was in 8th grade, one was in 10th grade. And she's like, "Julie, I make $8 an hour and I work 3 part-time jobs. I can't make enough to prove to a landlord that I'm a good tenant."
Yeah.
Ironically, the next guest we have coming on is none other than Jordan Chariton of Status Quo. And he just spent a handful of weeks across the Rust Belt talking about the housing crisis. And this thing is going to blow up very, very soon. It's going to be ugly. And I think, again, you know, having a living wage is nice, but there's so many infrastructural issues that exist. And it's ironic that you brought up Texas's 31st congressional district, because Jen and Donna happen to be very friendly. She is an awesome gal, and we obviously support her wholeheartedly. She is running again. And I'm hoping that you guys are going to play at least partially a role in trying to get Donna Imam across the finish line this time. I think she's got a great chance to do it. And, you know, again, Austin is, it's deep in the heart of Texas, because that is what it is. And, you know, I think if there is going to be a change, I do think that that is a flippable seat. And I think your organization, you know, could do some really phenomenal work, because like you said, you know, the GOP puts in the work 24/7, 365. The Democratic Party does not do that. And again, to the credit of the Republican Party, and yes, to the credit of Donald Trump, they really honed in on the working class voter. And that matters, because to them, this is life and death, even if the party ain't doing jack for them, and it isn't. But the messaging is key. But getting non-corporate representatives in is going to allow us to continue to build that grassroots movement that is going to be sustainable. Like you guys said, this is not about winning the next election. This is about winning the next generation. And I think we have a great chance to do that with guys like you really putting in the work and in the fight. And obviously, we're trying to hold down the fort here in Florida. It's not easy, but you know, we're doing what we can. We're learning.
Our states are very similar. Absolutely. We have very similar stuff. We have a right to work state. We have a serious labor problem. And Democratic Party does not represent labor. And we are right now a country with no labor party. And that's the problem. So when people start talking about third parties, I'm still wanting to know where's a second, because we don't really have a labor party, and that's where it is. And Peter had a conversation with someone the other day that's in the, like, trying to convince us that the Greens is the way to go. And it's just not. It's too niche. It even sounds niche. It sounds like a bunch of green hippies out in the woods doing God knows, and people aren't going to go for it. We need a labor party. And only a labor party is going to be broad enough to bring enough people in to actually be a viable party and not just a fringe. But yeah, that's exactly what I think. And I think that neither of our parties represents labor. That's what I think.
BrownGameTexas.org. Guys, final thoughts. Julie and Mike, please share with the audience. And guys, please go to the website if you can get involved, especially if you're in Texas. We really recommend that you go to an organization that is not going to be taking corporate special interest money. This is the blueprint that we need to follow, and they are definitely going to make an impact. So please, the floor is yours, guys.
I'll just say quickly, if you are in Austin, if you're watching and you're in Austin, please come sign one of our petitions. We have 25,000 signatures to collect by July 20th, which is now just 19 days away. So please go there. And if you want to volunteer with us, we would love to have you. We're a nonprofit. We rely on volunteer, you know, footwork. And so please sign up to get involved. We have a website, groundgametexas.org, and you can sign up there. If you want to learn more about this ballot initiative that's in Austin, go to GGTX. We're trying to make it super simple. GGTX.org/Austin. And Mike, I'll turn it to you.
Well, right on. Well, Jen, and thank you all so much for having us on. I love this camaraderie among like the leftist candidates, you know, past, present, and future. I mean, you know, Cori Bush, to me, she's the model. I mean, we need more Cori Bushes. And you know, y'all mentioned Donnie Mom. We don't know what the congressional districts are going to look like here. Like, yeah, they might be dramatically redrawn. But we're hopeful that, for example, if Austin gets a standalone district, we'll have a real progressive representative. Because we see how important every single one, the squad plus, whatever you want to call them, every single one of those folks is so precious. And so what we're trying to do is, you know, one at a time, one city at a time, one candidate at a time, lift people up and just let's just keep putting people in positions of power step by step. I mean, let's remain hopeful, right, that generational change is possible, that we're not going to lose to the Blue Lives Matter fascists and that they're not going to just hire more cops to protect their mansions. I mean, let's hope that we can turn this around a bit by bit. And we're trying to do our part here in Texas.
That's awesome. So,
Julie Oliver, Mike Siegel, thank you so much
for joining us. Thank you guys so much. It was nice to meet you, even though we were on the same slate. It was nice to meet you.
We will definitely be seeing you guys around, and we will definitely continue to talk about your organization. We hope to have you back in the near future.
Thanks so much, y'all. Take care.
Bye, guys.
Bye, guys.
Thanks for watching. If you want to support our mission to transform politics into service, please like this video, subscribe, follow us on social media, and consider joining our Patreon, where you'll get early access to our interviews as well as other exclusive content. Links are in the description. Peace out.